Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Cliff. Hey, this week you're going to want to pay close attention to the giveaway. I've been promising that each issue of the newsletter, the Earth Ancients newsletter, I would be giving something away. And this week you can get a free copy of the Ancient Mysteries and Advanced Archaeology Review that's put out by Bruce Cunningham. This magazine came out, started last year. And if you pay attention, you'll get your free copy. What you got to do, I'll give you a heads up. What you got to do, send me an email to cliff@earthancients.com, or better yet, just go to earthancients.com and register. When you register, you get the newsletter. And every month or every 2 months, you'll get the free item, whatever I give out. Today, I have a fun guest. It's David Hatcher Childress from History Channel's Ancient Alien. People don't realize that before he was on Ancient Aliens, he was a prolific writer. I mean, he's really, really amazing. I was reading his stuff 20 years ago. So, going to have fun with that. Also, as a reminder, check out New Living Expo, newlivingexpo.com. I'm going to be presenting a panel discussion on Ancient Aliens. So I hope you'll join me. That's going to be Saturday, April 29th in San Francisco, newlivingexpo.com. Okay, so here's today's program. Saturday, April 15th, 2017. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Finally got a copy of my article. Came out just yesterday, Uncovering Ancient Pyramid Science at Teotihuacan, Where Men Become Gods. It's now available. It's produced by Ancient Origins. That's a big, big magazine that's put out in Ireland, but has an international audience, and I'm really happy to be with him. You can read all about it on the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, go to the group page. I'm also going to have it available on the newsletter, and I'll have it on the website. So I hope you'll enjoy that. One of the things that they did that I thought was kind of interesting is they found one of these interesting pyrite balls that was discovered in the tunnel at Teotihuacan in the Pyramid of the Serpent. And there really hadn't been a good close-up of this golden ball, a pyrite ball. And the publisher of Ancient Origins magazine found one of these balls that was discovered in Peru. And they have a close-up of it in this article, and it's quite amazing. It's like they rolled it in pyrite. It's not real cleanly applied to the surface of this ball. It's as we know, the ball is made up of really hard clay and some kind of mineral, like they think it's some kind of rock that was formed, and then they rolled the pyrite on top of that. And when you look at this close-up in this article, and I meant to talk to the publisher and go, hey, this is fantastic. I haven't got a chance to thank her for that. But when you look at the close-up, you can see that it's applied in such a way that it either gives off particles of the pyrite or whatever, because when the archaeologist Pedro Gomez actually was commenting about this tunnel, the pyrite was not only on the ground in the form of these little balls, but it was all over the walls of this tunnel system that went from the entrance of this main cavern all the way underneath the pyramid. So quite amazing. And I'd be interested to know what you think too. So check that out. And it is available on the Facebook page. Hey, I want to let you know that we're putting together and have finalized all the details to an amazing tour in Yucatan, Mexico. Now, we were supposed to have it this month, but I really didn't like the price that this other company was charging. And so we have a brand new company, and these guys are amazing. The tour is Journey to the Land of the Maya. It's going to be October 28th through November 4th. And it's a solid week. I mean, what they put together is amazing. We're going to go to Mayapan, Uxmal, Sayil, Labna, Koba, Chichen Itza, Esna, and a ton of other places. And it's one of the cheapest tours I've ever seen. If you want some more information about this tour, if you want to join me for the Halloween weekend, which, by the way, we'll also get to interact with people there who are doing Day of the Dead. So Day of the Dead is right after Halloween in our country, and then they start Day of the Dead there. We're going to be flying into Mérida, and we'll hang out at a really cool hotel, and then we'll bus. We'll have a private bus to these really, really cool ruins, and we have access to all of them. So if you're interested, send me an email. Say, hey, Cliff, I'm interested in more information. Next week, we'll launch the official page with all the itinerary, all the details. Send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com, and I'll get you the itinerary. It's really the best tour of the year. And when you see the price, you're gonna be blown away. It's so cheap. I mean, it's really what I wanted from the beginning, a very inexpensive, easy access tour in Mérida. And if you live in the United States, getting to Mérida is very inexpensive. I mean, I'm out here in San Francisco, and my trip is only like about $400. So that's nothing. That's totally zero. So, hey, I hope you can join me. Let me know, cliff@earthancients.com. Earth Ancients is brought to you by Gaia. And remember, Gaia is probably one of the best resources for all subjects on Earth Ancients, except that they have their own production company, and they have a whole series of really, really solid presentations. Cosmic Disclosure by David Wilcock and Corey Good is going into its part 7 section, where they begin looking at connection with other worlds. There's also Beyond Belief with George Norrie. Journey to the Akashic Records. I mean, there's just constant updates and information. I was looking at Missing Links, which is hosted by Greg Braden. It's a brand new series that has just finished, but you can get the whole series if you go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients. That's gaia.com/Earth Ancients. And for 99 cents, you can start into a full month of the program and get a sense of it. And after the first month, it's about $9. But hey, there are thousands of original programs on aliens, NASA's space program, pyramids. I mean, there is so much to look at. I think they claim to have 7,000 titles. I think it's closer to 8 now, because I've been talking about that for a few months now, and it's there's just so much to consider. So check it out. Remember, they sponsor Earth Ancients. Go to gaia.com/Earth Ancients. I think you're going to like their material.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Lots of good stuff to post. You know, remember, just go to Earth Ancients on the Facebook page, and there's not just me. We have a world-class group of research investigators, original authors, and scientists that are posting on this Facebook page. I want to let you know about a piece of film footage that I received that is from 1897, when moving pictures were in their infancy. And it's a series of camera shots of the Sphinx in Giza. And you have to look at this piece of film. It's about 3 or 4 minutes. It's really short. But it's pointing at the head of the Sphinx, and it looks completely different. I mean, you can see a lot of details that are not there now. And I don't know, but I suspect that because of the weathering, because of the carbon monoxide that's in the air from car pollution, the Sphinx is eroded. I mean, it really has eroded. And when you look at these early shots, you see details of the nose, of the face. The nose was blown off right after Napoleon. But you can see more details that are just not present right now. So check that out. I was really surprised at what I was able to see. And it's not obviously it's a black and white. It's not color, but the details are quite interesting. Check it out. You'll like that. I mentioned my article in Ancient Origins magazine. I've posted it on the Facebook page. It's getting a lot of play. I'm going to be writing an article every month. The new article for, I think it's going to come out at the end of this month for May, is on a discovery I made on the observatory. It's a building at Chichen Itza, Yucatan, Mexico. And that's a very, very curious, and it's a very anomalously structured building. Very unusual why they did certain things. So check that out there. And also, this month, we're featuring Japan's megalithic culture. It's highlighted the huge megaton monoliths. There's a gallery of huge stonework. There's even some very finely cut stone that's timeless. And it's all presented by Kara Yamaguchi, who's a researcher there. And she's written an interesting book on super civilizations of Japan. Kara will be my guest at the end of this month, so stay tuned for that. She'll be on the show and featured in an interview April 29th. Also, check out Japan's, it's called the Tenchu Iwo Rock and Yakushima Island. This is considered one of the largest megaliths in the entire world. And when you look at this gallery of this Tenchu Iwo Rock, you'll see why. It's definitely man-made, but it's a monster. And we don't hear about it because the Japanese are very quiet about their unknown ancient past. They don't really discuss it. In fact, in some cases, Kari Yamaguchi talks about the need for more preservation. And I think she's reaching out to some of the institutes here in America. So check it out on Facebook. You'll like that. You'll get a chance to see those monoliths. One of the oldest human settlements ever found in North America has been discovered. It's in Canada, just above Victoria. A 14,000-year-old settlement, an early city, has been discovered, and some of the artifacts are quite advanced. There's cutting tools, dolls, some of the most amazing artifacts ever found, which is pushing back civilized man's presence in North America even further. So something to consider. As always, go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, and check it out. You know, take a look at these galleries. They're kind of cool. I think you'll like them. So every week, we have a new contributor to our news section, and this week we have Bruce Cunningham, who is the publisher of the Ancient Mysteries and Advanced Archaeology Review. The good thing about this magazine is that it covers quite a bit of information on known and unknown megalithic cultures. And also, you're going to get a free copy of this if you go to earthancients.com and sign up. But I wanted to talk a little bit to Bruce about this work that he's done. He moved recently from Michigan. Now he is in the Philippines. And I gave him a call the other day, and I wanted to know a little bit more about what he had done in researching this publication. So this week we're traveling to the Philippines, and we're going to talk to an old friend who goes way back with Earth Ancients, Bruce Cunningham. Bruce is the publisher of the Ancient Mysteries and Advanced Archaeology Review, which is a really cool online magazine that has reviews of new locations, new discoveries, and a whole bunch of very, very cool things. And so we wanted to have Bruce on simply because he does contribute a lot of information. He's been doing tours for a couple of years now. But this week, we have a very cool offering for you, our listening audience, Bruce has said that he is going to give anyone who registers on his internet page a copy of this fantastic magazine, The Ancient Mysteries and Advanced Archaeology Review. Bruce, how you doing out there?
Hey, I'm doing real good, Cliff. It's a fairly sunny day here on Island Paradise, and life is good. I'm talking to you.
Cool. Hey, tell me a little bit about this magazine. What was the brainchild behind launching such a cool publication?
Well, basically, as you know, I kind of started the whole idea of advanced archaeology. Instead of using negative terms like rogue or alternative, I thought, you know, if you have alternative theories, are they not advanced? And then, you know, I'm familiar and very good friends with so many different authors around the world. I thought, you know, we ought to put a magazine together with a lot of these cool articles in it.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you have some really sophisticated photographs. You're friends with, and you work with people like Dr. Danny Hillman, a number of authors, a number of researchers, and so these are first-rate articles I've seen in your publication. So you launched it in June of last year, June 2016. And how many issues do you put out a year? Do you put out one a month?
Right now it's bi-monthly. We're hoping to make it monthly. But right now it's bi-monthly.
Okay. And this issue that we're giving away for free to our listeners, what is that issue? Do you know? Oh, I think it's June.
Yeah.
I think it's the first one.
Yeah, we have first issue, but it also be we have four issues. We're doing number five, should be out here very soon. It's going to be actually focused on Gunung Padang with a couple articles.
Okay.
And one will be an interview with Dr. Hillman.
Okay, and so the one we're going to be giving away to people is the premier issue, right? It's the June issue.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
I work with my publisher, I believe it is.
Yeah.
It actually has a... It's focused on Nan Madol, which, mm-hmm. as we know, is such an amazing site in the middle of the ocean, similar to Easter Island. And the author, Alistair McCombs, was there about a year and a half ago, and he will be actually at my event here in the Philippines next week.
Right. We should tell people that you are also a tour operator. You also do conferences, and so you're in the thick of it, which is fantastic. So Nan Madol is where? Where's that located?
It's in Pohnpei, Micronesia, and it's a megalithic basalt log city.
Oh, right.
Literally in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, mainstream researchers have it less than 2,000 years old. But if you look at these pictures, it appears to be so much like Gunung Padang. And being where it's at, it has to be much, much more ancient and built by... Civilization X is about all we can call it.
Right. Some of the blocks of basalt, I think they weigh over almost a ton, don't they? Some of the big...
No. Some of them are like up to 30 to 60 tons.
Oh, my God.
Some of them are, you know, megalithic for sure. Okay. And it's literally a city, and it goes into the ocean. There has been some divers there, but I guess it's so dark that it's really, really difficult diving.
Okay. Yeah, I took a look at the publication, and it's filled with Mamadal, and there's other articles by other authors. So, and this is something that you've started out and you have a real passion for, which is fantastic. So, we appreciate that. I appreciate you offering that first issue. I'll mention a little bit later how they can get it. For now, what you got to do is go to earthancients.com, and we'll make it available to people. I'll also list it on the Facebook page so people can go to it. Bruce, it's been a pleasure as always, and enjoy retirement, my friend.
I will, and it's just so ironic that I am here in San Francisco, Cebu, talking to San Francisco, California.
Oh, really? I didn't.
It's even the same. Actually, I'm Camotes Island, so it's San Francisco, CA, the mm-hmm. same as your San Francisco, CA, but Camotes, not California.
That's kind of cool. All right, my friend, we'll be in touch as always, and thanks for talking with us today.
All right. Thank you very much, Cliff.
There is a great deal we simply do not understand about ancient Indonesia, Southeast Asia, and a lot of surrounding areas. I've seen tremendous similarities between Central and South American pyramids and the cultures that are in Indonesia. Some of the structures there are dead on. And there's a growing awareness of some kind of a cultural exchange that is prehistoric, thousands and thousands of years, perhaps before people even arrived in Central and South America, what is known as diffusionism. And we've heard from academics telling us about this and letting us know that they believe that there is something happening. And my guest today is David Hatcher Childress, and most of you know David from his Ancient Alien fame and his regular appearances on that show. But before he was working on the History Channel's Ancient Aliens, he was writing about his travels around the world. 20 years ago, I had a book from his travels in South America and Central America, what he had discovered. But David's a world traveler, and his work in Southeast Asia in this new book he's going to talk about today is quite an eye-opener for me, especially in Vietnam. Now, I didn't know there was anything in Vietnam that is extremely old, but I think you're going to enjoy this interview. So it's always a pleasure to have David Hatcher Childress on the program, and David has just come out with a new book, and it's funny that this book has come out at this time. It's actually very timely, based on the last series of guests we've had on the program. And so, hey, David, it's great to have you on the program again.
Hi, Cliff. Yeah, good to be on your show.
Before we start, I just want to let you know that we had Dr. Richard Hansen on the program, who's the director of the El Mirador Project in Guatemala. And he's excavating the El Mirador complex, which is monstrous.
And okay, I've been there. Wow, that's great.
But he made a very interesting statement that actually is a great prelude to what we're talking about today, which is this new book. And what he said was actually quite mind-blowing, and it shows that independent researchers like yourself are really cutting a path to more academic side, which tends to be more reticent about revealing information. And this is what he said, along with Dr. Michael Cole, who's one of the foremost Mayanists in the country. He's now 86. they were in a conference together about a year ago, and they were talking about the interest that not only is prevalent in Central America with the various cultures there, but Cole himself stated that if he had had more time, he's 86, if he had had more time, he would have done more research in Indonesia, because he strongly believes now that there's a tremendous case for diffusionism or cultural exchange among Indonesian cultures and not only the Maya, but the cultures that were prevalent in Central America thousands of years ago. Now, when I hear something like that, and I see this new book this new book's called The Lost World of Cham, the Trans
Cam, actually, is the way
Cam?
You say that.
Excuse me.
Cam, yeah, Cam.
Oh, thanks.
That's why it can be spelled with a K, too, like in Khmer, Cambodia.
Oh, Khmer. Okay,
that,
well,
yeah,
good.
See, all these, okay. They're the same word, but as I point out in my book, The Lost World of Cam, which is exactly about what you're talking about, Indonesia,
yeah,
and Southeast Asia and,
yeah,
and trans-Pacific voyages, the Hindus and Buddhists who ran that whole world. And what, you know what really amazed me, Cliff, when as I began working on that book last year and making some trips to Southeast Asia, and I'd made a number already, and
mm-hmm,
I went back again in November and was in Thailand and in Java and Bali on that trip, was that the ancient history of Southeast Asia is very mysterious. It's virtually,
yeah,
unknown. It surprised me. I mean, historians, you know, archaeologists, just your mainstream guys, like Michael Coe, would be a good example. I mean, they're all saying, you know, that in ancient India and in ancient Egypt and Sumeria and in ancient Mexico and Peru, that there were all of these dynasties and civilizations, and they were building pyramids and ports and big cities. And I mean, back to 1000 BC, 2000 BC, 3000 BC easily. I mean, you know, with Sumeria and certainly Egypt and in my mind, ancient India is easily that old too. But what is incredible is that the history of Southeast Asia is not there like that. They don't really have and can put their finger on and name any real civilization there. That's BC. About the oldest civilizations that they can come up with are the Kampa, the Kham in Vietnam, and they date, according to the mainstream, to about 190 AD. So about 200 AD, but yet we have all of the stories in ancient India and Asoka, Buddha, of course, himself, from 500 BC, the Hindus themselves in the Sanskrit languages, they talked about what they called the land of gold, which was called Suvarma Bhumi,
mm-hmm,
in Sanskrit. And in fact, that is the name today of the big international airport in Bangkok. They call it the Suvarna Bhumi airport, which is,
yeah,
and it's one of the, you know, most modern and the largest airports in Southeast Asia. So that is named after this ancient kind of mythical, quasi-mythical land called the Land of Gold. And if you can look it up online or something, and I talk about it in my book, that, yeah, clearly Suvarma Bhumi is Indonesia and Southeast Asia in general, Malaysia, Cambodia, yeah, Thailand, and southern Vietnam. And it kind of started in Sumatra. And if you look up some of the definitions or something of Suvarma Bhumi, they'll say that, well, it somehow was Sumatra or you know, beyond that. Southeast Asia is an amazing place, and clearly civilization, and it would be a Hindu and later a Buddhist civilization starting around 400 BC,
mm-hmm,
was there all throughout Southeast Asia. And see, now the Thai people, like the Viet people, they came later, and they came from really China and immigrated southward, the Thais basically taking over what today we call Thailand, and then and the Viets taking over what is Vietnam. So, but before that, there was this other group of people who lived there, and they are the Kampa and the Kham. And in the mainstream, they're saying that, well, the Kampa were just in southern Vietnam and right around the Mekong Delta area. But to go to Cambodia, which also has the same word and name, Cam, you have to go from the basically the Mekong Delta, which is in Vietnam, then inland into the lakes and rivers and stuff of Cambodia. Plus, these guys were all, they were crossing the Pacific, just like Ko and that archaeologist you were saying at El Mirador.
Yeah, Dan Hansen. And this is what's amazing to me is I've been seeing examples of pyramids in Indonesia. One of the one that's really interesting is the Candi Suka, which is in, it's a Javanese pyramid. And it's a dead ringer for a Mayan pyramid. And traditional archaeologists really don't want to look at it as a comparative study. Where, and here's Cole at the end of his life saying, I would have spent more time considering the Indonesian pyramids. And then here's your book, David, that kind of ties it in with beautifully photographed images and things like this. What do we know about the Kham, the Khmer group? How old are they? Do we know anything at all about them?
Well, sure. We can trace them pretty much to at least 200 AD, 192 AD in southern Vietnam, where they were, and they were in central Vietnam too, around Da Nang. There was an island. There's a small group of islands that's off of Da Nang. Their big stronghold was really what we would call central Vietnam, right really where North and South Vietnam were being divided, and a lot of the fighting during the Vietnam War was occurring in this area. The Cam, or I should say Kampa in this sense, in Vietnam, they had a number of cities, and these cities were megalithic. They're also using bricks, so they have bricks towers also combined with granite and basalt. They're cutting large granite and basalt blocks, and basalt's very difficult to cut with precision cutting, and what we call the what I call those keystone cuts, the trademark T or hourglass shaped cuts. And you see those also at a site up in northern Cambodia called Priya Vihear. And that also is an ancient site. What's kind of going on in Southeast Asia, what I'm finding, and a lot of the monuments in Cambodia, I think, fit into this, Priya Vihear particularly, are much older than what the mainstream archaeologists are saying, and which is a similar thing that's going on in Peru with a lot of the buildings around Cusco, and would it also include Machu Picchu and Ollantaytambo and Pizac, Sacsayhuaman, those megalithic cities around there. They're much older. They're not built by the Incas. They're at least hundreds of years before the Incas, and in some cases maybe thousands. I mean, it's a problem. And in fact, Priya Vihear, which is also this megalithic city, and it's on top of a mountain like Machu Picchu. I talk about this in my book there, Cliff, The Lost World of Cam, how Machu Picchu is really a copy of this Cam city, which was probably older, called Priya Vihear, which is today in very northern Cambodia. Tourists could only go there starting a few years ago. Tourists, you won't have met very many people, even people who've been to Angkor Wat. And I first went to Angkor Wat in 1999 when Cambodia was first just opening to tourists. Today, there's a lot of tourists there. It's a backpacker's mecca. It's a fun country, and it's cheap there, too. And have you ever been to Cambodia?
I haven't. I need to get over there, though. That's like on my bucket list to get over to that site. It's huge.
It's really fantastic. And there is a very much a similarity as Coe is, and these other guys are finally starting to realize, the Smithsonian Institute as well has, they're on board with this too, that Shang Chinese were traveling across the Pacific, and these Indonesians, and they're a mystery bunch, the Olmecs in Mexico, and the Mayans. But here was the thing I was saying about Da Nang too. You have these megalithic structures that are there, and even they couldn't, archaeologists could not figure out how they fired these brick stupas that are there. Archaeologists were baffled on how they actually made some of the things that they made. But there was a group of islands that's off of Da Nang, central Vietnam, and they're called the Cam Islands.
Okay.
And those islands, yeah, are rocky. They are inhabited. They're a pearl area and stuff like that. They have big sandy beaches. And apparently what would happen is these huge ships of the Cam, and they were coming from all over Southeast Asia. They were coming from Bali and Java and Sumatra. They were coming from Malaysia and up the Mekong River in Cambodia. And they would also come down from China as well. And these huge fleets of ships would meet at these Cam Islands, and there was big sandy beaches there where just as many ships as possible could pull up, and these ships would be fully loaded, ready to go, and then they would leave from there and go out into the Pacific. And one of the areas that they were then going to would be like Nan Madol, this amazing basalt city that's in Micronesia. And if you've heard about that, Nan Madol on Island.
Yeah.
So that too may have been built by the Cam. But these guys are, I mean, there's something magical here. They're not only have got huge ships, and giant fleets of ships. And it just Southeast Asia in general had to have in ancient times, 1000 BC at least, huge navies going around from island to island. I mean, it just, there's no other way to travel there except by aircraft and stuff like that. But they're levitating. They have giant stones. They're moving things that stones that we couldn't move today, like Nam Madol particularly. Kriavihir is a giant megalithic city. They don't know how they could build all these things. They would have had to have power tools.
Let me talk about one site that you have in the very beginning of your book that is fascinating. It's in Vietnam. It's called, is it My Son?
My Son, yes, My Son. And that's near Da Nang, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is a quite interesting city, and you actually show similar types of cutting techniques that are found in Bolivia, Pumapuku, and could be it's in Bolivia.
Pumapunku and Tiwanaku. Yeah. Also in Peru, it's at Cusco and also at a place called Ollantaytambo. Yeah, exactly. So here you have people on both sides of the Pacific making walls and structures with this unusual T-shaped cuts. Those cuts would be they'd be a double T, and they would have to span two blocks of stone, and then liquid metal is poured into this. So you're looking at also a metallurgical plant where they're melting metals and alloys. They're creating their own alloys for these clamps. So yeah, these guys are building amazing stuff, and nothing is too big for them or impossible to do. They're like these, the Hindu gods or something like that, who can have flying machines, can fly through the air, have all kinds of amazing weapons and stuff like that. So that's what we have here.
Right. What would you say the diversity is, or the exchange? Would you say it's ancient Mayan civilization exchanging pyramid building construction techniques with Indonesia, or do you think Indonesia is more of the evidence from the mother culture, maybe from Lemuria? then they pass it to the Maya. What do you say? Do you have any feeling about that?
Well, yeah, I do. And I feel that there would have been definitely, you know, a cultural exchange both ways. But I think that the mother culture here really was ancient India and Indonesia and ancient China as well.
Okay.
In my book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, which is kind of a companion book in some ways, although it's like 6 or 7 years old now. In that book, I really look at the Olmecs and how mysterious they are. Many of them also looking like Africans, but other Olmecs look like they're bearded or Chinese. The Olmecs, like the Cam people, were a mixture of races. Seafarers in general are kind of like that on pirate ships and things like that. They're often a motley crew of people from all over the world. And on the ancient, you know, particularly on ships, ancient ships as well, you're not judged so much by how you look or the color of your skin or what kind of hair you have or anything like that, but more on your ability and you're part of the team. And so the Cam were a group that were very varied. Many of them were blacks. And you have in particularly in eastern Indonesia, and then once you get into New Guinea and New Caledonia and those areas, people are blacks. They have dark skin, frizzy hair. They're supposedly black people are from Africa, but we've got them in these islands off Indonesia and stuff. And they would have, in theory, had to have come there in ships somehow, because they couldn't really walk to all these islands. Unless, again, now you have your theories of lost continent of Mu or Lemuria, where there was a lost continent around Indonesia, which they call Sunda Land. And
right.
So exactly. That area. So here you go. You know, just as far as all that kind of thing happens, you've got geologists are saying that during the last ice age, 10,000 years ago, they're saying that sea levels were 300 feet lower than they are today. Well, if you drop the sea levels around Indonesia 300 feet, you're going to have, a new continent, basically, that is created. All these islands will be connected together. There's a thing they call the Wallace Line, which is still deeper than 300 feet. And that separates part of eastern Indonesia from western Indonesia. But, yeah, you have – so even, you know, they think that rice began – early rice was created in Indonesia. You have the different islands there, Sulawesi. You have Bata Valley. You have strange megaliths all throughout parts of Indonesia. And I have some interesting photos in that book, I think, that you will, you know.
It's filled with wonderful photographs. That's what's so amazing to me. And you have great examples of this so-called exchange of culture, or as the scientists would like to tell us, diffusionism. You have a great example that I didn't even realize where you show Tiwanaku and some of their sculptures. And one of the sculptures is very reminiscent of Kon-Tiki, and that's definitely in the Indonesian area. And why would that be in South America? It's quite unusual.
And that, you know, Thor Heyerdahl, the famous Norwegian archaeologist, back in the 1950s, and he actually started the late 1940s living in the Marquesa Islands, but he's the one who really tried to promote the idea of Tiki, Kon-Tiki. There's the Kon-Tiki statue, that's at Tiwanaku in Bolivia, and he's got a beard and a mustache, and he's holding his arms, in what's called the Tiki position. And that Tiki position is one hand on your heart, your right hand, and then your left hand down on your stomach. And that's the famous Tiki position. If you go to Tahiti, New Zealand as well. You buy these pendants of tiki. In New Zealand, they're often of a jade-type greenstone. And if tiki is always doing that with his hand as it's on his heart, his hands on his stomach. So you have that in Bolivia. You have that in all kinds of tiki-type statues around the world. And, yeah, it has, you know, it obviously has something to do with the Pacific Ocean, the sailors crossing it. But, see, Thor Heyerdahl was, with his books, Kon-Tiki was the name of one, Aku Aku. He tried to also show how Easter Island was somehow connected, not just to South America, but also to Indonesia and those countries mm-hmm. there. But yeah. It was archaeologists like, say, Michael Coe, who, when he was a powerful Mayanist for many years, and he was very much an isolationist. He yeah. did not agree on this transoceanic travel. He's famous. I had to quote him in my book, The Mystery of the Olmecs, where, you know, there's another famous archaeologist at the University of Alabama named Richard Deal, and he wrote a book about the Olmecs. And like what Coe said, too, is that, well, yeah, these guys look like Negroes. They look very much like blacks, he said, but they're not, you know, they're not really blacks. They're just, you know, he mentions that the Philippines have some, you know, blacks. And in fact, that was what the Cam people were in Vietnam. They were also basically blacks. And, but he still wants them to walk through Siberia and down through Americas. Okay.
It's so
he has changed his mind a lot, but so many people like Thor Heyerdahl were essentially poo-pooed and they were, you know, the mainstream would say, well, there's, you know, he's not offering any new evidence, but there's a lot of evidence, in fact.
You show something, and you've been mentioning this, and I see it prevalent in the Olmec culture, and this Kham culture has it too, and that is a diversity of cultures. And you've said it, you see these African-centric faces, you see these Asiatic faces, and this is something that I have not read in any anthropological study, any archaeological review or paper. The sheer diversity of the cultures that were sprawling all over Central America and appear to be sprawling all over Indonesia. And it's just too much for the academics to claim that there would be that level of diversity, or they don't have anything to say about it. They can't figure it out, so they'd rather just be quiet about it. And, I mean, other than independent researchers like yourself, I think it's a very important fact, very, very important, that is not addressed.
Well, for sure. And, you know, there's more to it than that, even. One of my books from a couple of years ago I co-wrote it, called The Enigma of Cranial Deformation. And it's a book all about these cone heads, cranial deformation, people having these elongated heads. In Peru, you see it a lot. I was just in Peru, and I'm always take photos of all these unusual elongated craniums and stuff when I'm down there. And Those museums there, they put them on display. They don't make too big of a deal of it, although they tell you not to take photos now and things like that. But I already have lots of photos of these things. In fact, if anything, they've put fewer of these elongated heads out, but they still put some out. But here's the thing, is that I also found, when I wrote that book with Brian Forster, and it surprised me that there were no other books ever written on the subject. And in fact, there weren't really even magazine articles. There was the few little articles on the web, very occasionally, like, for instance, Richard Deal in his book on the Olmecs, where he's this very scholarly book. But again, he's saying that, yeah, they're just these isolated people in Mexico. They have no connection with even other civilizations in Mexico, he didn't think. But in his whole book, he only mentions the elongated heads one time. And yet the Olmecs are famous in their sculpture. I mean, almost every one of their jade or ceramic sculptures it shows an elongated head, and yet he won't discuss it. Well, here's the problem. If you're an isolationist and you don't think that there's any connection between all these different civilizations and there's no transoceanic contact, well, how, you know, you can't really discuss people with these elongated heads because they're all over the world. They're in Egypt. They're in Malta. They're in Vanuatu. They're in Peru. They're in Mexico. They're in Seattle area, too, the flathead Indians. They were in Hungary. The Koreans did these elongated heads. So, and that's an unusual thing to do. Why are people doing this unusual, weird thing all over the world? He would have to argue, or anybody, Michael Coe, for that matter, too, they would have to argue that all of these people all over the world are doing this independently, that there's no connection between one people, you know, in one group doing this elongated conehead ritual, which is so bizarre anyway, that all these people are doing it independently. And they have to say the same thing about these keystone cuts. There's no connection between these different sites. It just happens to be two completely independent, unconnected civilizations doing exactly the same thing. That's very specialized and not something that, you know, people would just, you know, do or make up on their own. So you can't.
I think that's the reason why Cole has come out as a research scientist to say that there's just too much compelling evidence from what he's seen throughout Indonesia and in Central America to say it doesn't have a connection. And that's why he says if he had it to do it over again, he would spend more time studying the
well, he should and spend more time writing new books that totally, you know, this is a guy writing textbooks, okay? And now, at the end of his life, he's decided that his own textbooks that he has written are wrong. I mean, that's an amazing statement for him to make.
I was
in my mind
when I heard it. The thing that is fascinating about your book also, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about it, is these Kham and also people around that Indonesian area, they're megalithic builders. They're building on a huge scale. And you compare it quite well with Pumapuku in Bolivia and other locations in South America. And it's like, this is a big deal. Megalithic building is very challenging because we're talking about multi-ton stones, moving them from places. We don't know how they moved them. But it's just a fascinating review that you have in your book, Mike.
Well, thanks for that. And, and exactly, you know, what you're saying is right. You have to have great admiration for the stonemasons and these architects. I mean, somebody, just like a shopping center or, you know, some giant skyscraper, has to be planned and an airport drawn out and this is what we're going to need and then, you know, this is how we're going to put it all together and this and that and all that has to be done, and on a grand scale, in some of these cases. Borobudur, I was also amazed on my recent trip to Java and going to Borobudur, and I went to the Gunung Padon place too, with all these strange.
I gotta talk to you
basalt,
about that.
Basalt, yeah, and see that's kind of like Namadol, where all this basalt is stacked up, you know, a million tons of it or something. But Borobudur is a huge monument. It's the world's largest Buddhist stupa, basically. It's megalithic. It's cut out of granite and basalt. It's like a man-made mountain. Some people think that it was actually an artificial lake was created around it at one point. Today, it's the number one tourist site in Java and probably all of Indonesia, really. But no one knows who built it. No one takes credit for it. They know it's a Buddhist site, and it's got all these Buddhas on it and the life of Buddhas done in stone frescoes along the side. It's a mandala pilgrimage site. But no one knows who built it. No one has ever taken credit for it. And they assign it to some dynasty, a Java dynasty called the Solendras, just to, you know, give it some attribution. But they're baffled by this place. And really, as I say, you know, the Cam had to build it. Whoever is doing it, I mean, they are builders par excellence. They have power tools and saws. They're able to cut stone. There are keystone cuts, too, at Borobudur. They're making beautiful, fantastic statues. And these people have a lot of metals. They've got gold. They've got silver. They've got iron and copper, bronzes, all kinds of different alloys, gold and silver type alloys, electrum. Just last year, this was a new scientific research that came out. They've created this new super metal. Some scientists, it was like in August, I read it as a news thing. It's the strongest metal that's ever been created, and it's an alloy of gold and titanium. So here you have gold being part of this new strongest metal ever created. And that's what the CAM were doing too. They were mining. They had metallurgical areas where, and mining is very complicated, where you're not just mining ores, but you have to have kilns. You have to have what are called crucibles. You have to melt the ores in huge furnaces. You have to get certain temperatures up, and then you're pouring molten metal. That's what was going on at Tiwanaku. So that's another problem, too, that I point out in my book, The Lost World of CAM, and also in my book, Ancient Technology in Peru and Bolivia, which is also about the Keystone Cuts and Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, and how the Incas didn't really build a lot of the things that they're attributed to them, rather than these buildings were already there.
Exactly.
But here's what the mainstream archaeologists are missing, is that these huge sites like Tiwanaku they're a mining site. The whole place is a metallurgical complex. Chavin in Peru is like that too. You can't, these people are getting, you know, molten metals from somewhere, and archaeologists don't really explain that. Where's the metallurgical site? They can sometimes say, well, here's the old mine where, you know, they were getting some copper and stuff. But you have to refine it. You have to wash the ores. That's why they do things like divert a river. You create a canal city. At Tiwanaku, they had a reservoir on top of a pyramid of water that they used to wash the ores and stuff with. And just to fill a reservoir on top of a pyramid requires pumping water uphill. And there are ways to do that. There's what they call ram pumps and stuff like that.
Yeah. So I've heard some talk about Tiwanaku being a refinery, a metal refinery, but and also I've read about these underground canals that they have that passed water. But do we know for a fact that it was a factory of some kind that was where metals were processed? Or
well, I mean, it's what I'm saying. I don't know if we know it for a fact. Mainstream. That's kind of my point, that mainstream archaeologists aren't recognizing it as a, you know, metallurgical plant. They see it as some kind of and the same thing with Chavin, which is another site also that's in Peru, and it's a megalithic site where they've diverted a river and there's underground tunnels and that. And what you've got there is with all these places, you have all these metals. And we know that the Incas and at Tiwanaku and stuff, that there was just gold and silver everywhere, and other metals too, copper and tin and whatnot. But so where were they making all that? Then they have these towers that are there, like along Lake Titicaca. There's a couple of spots for them. One is called Silusani. They're mainly in Peru. Another site is called Cutimbo. And they are these megalithic stone towers on top of these mesas. And archaeologists can't explain them. They say, oh, they're burial towers for the dead. The people just live in kind of crummy mud huts, but they build these wonderful megalithic towers for the dead people. But the thing is, see, these towers are, they're part of the metallurgical process. That's for, that's the furnaces that that they were melting the ores in. And you see, the first step in that is also charcoal. In order to really melt metals and have a hot furnace, you need charcoal. And the way you make charcoal is by, you've got to chop down wood, and then you build a huge bonfire and just get it really hot, and then you bury it in a, you just bury it in dirt. And the heat of the fire that's already started then turns the rest of the wood into charcoal. I lived in Sudan back in the late 70s, and I had to go out and buy charcoal. I was working with Chevron Oil at the time, and I was running a camp. So anyway, so that's like the first step in mining. So now you have to have tons, literally, of charcoal, and then you have to have a furnace to put the ore in and the charcoal. You have to light these big charcoal fires, get them really hot, and then in the end, what happens is the what they call the tears of the sun, which is, if you go to the Gate of the Sun at Tiwanaku, there's this god is there on the top with a feathered headdress, and tears are coming down his cheeks. And he's like crying, but the, what he's really crying is droplets of gold and droplets of silver and droplets of copper and stuff. So it's all part of this whole metallurgical process. Where, see, the mainstream archaeologists are saying, oh, well, it's... No, this was just a ceremonial site where priests came and, you know, did some ceremony or something like that.
They always revert to the lowest common denominator of intelligence. It always drives me nuts. It's like, well, this was symbolic for priests worshiping and the shamans came here. Like, wait a minute.
Well, right. And then sometimes it's just like, well, the shamans needed to come there and take their hallucinogenic drugs or something. You know, but they have to do it on top of these megalithic pyramids and stuff and, you know, huge sites and things like. So it's kind of, you realize that there's something more going on here than just some shaman taking some drugs.
They contradict themselves, I think, on some of those thoughts. Hey, listen, I just discovered in your book here that you took a trip to Jakarta and you went to the Gunung Padang site. What did you think about it? You were with your wife, and we've talked to Danny Hillman on the show, who was the
I have not really talked to him, but yeah, I know about him. Sure.
No, but I mean, they've basically stopped the excavation. It's been a couple of years now, and he can't get the funding. And they left off by discovering a much older date and a couple of different rooms buried in the pyramid. But I'm just curious, what was your impression of the place?
Gunung Padang, yeah. I went to the Gunung Padang pyramid, and it was a really interesting site. I looked for those tunnels and passageways that Danny Hillman had been talking about, and they're not there anymore. I mean, they've covered them up. I don't know.
Oh, God, really?
I couldn't see any of that. It's not really a pyramid. It's like a, it's kind of part of a kind of ridge of a mountain. There are these steps. I mean, it is man-made stuff there for sure, and there's all this basalt that's been piled up and stacked up. I mean, it's weird. Exactly what, you know, they were doing there or why, it's baffling. And but the one thing I will say is that there's a lot of work. I mean, whoever was doing that at Gunung Padang, I mean, some critics say that it's kind of a natural site in a way, and that the basalt is coming from right there, essentially, and that may well be the case, but still, people have definitely moved this basalt around, and you know, I can tell you, I've been to Nan Madol in the Pacific, and I've been there like 5 times. That place is really something else. It's the 8th wonder of the world. It's over 250 million tons of basalt, very similar to Gunung Padang, only on a much bigger scale, and huge walls and artificial islands, walls that are 30 feet high. they estimate that there's over 250 million tons of basalt that's been moved and stacked up on this island, and they don't even know where that basalt came from. It had to come from somewhere else. The natives there in Namadol, they claim that it was magically flown through the air, all of this basalt, and that they flew it from the other side of the island. I mean, some of the basalt columns there weigh 80 tons, and that's much more than any of the ones at Gunung Padang. I would say at Gunung Padang, the largest basalt column I saw there would have weighed maybe a couple of tons, perhaps, maybe 2 or 3 tons, possibly, which is still pretty heavy. But ones at Namadol in Micronesia, I mean, these things are 10 tons, 20 tons, 50 tons, and the heaviest one they think is 80 tons. I mean, an entire mountain would have been dismantled to get all the material that's used in this city. I mean, archaeologists, again, are baffled, although they don't, they don't talk about it much. There's not much they can say. They just say, oh, some islanders, you know, put these basalt rocks on their little double canoes and, you know, brought them to the island.
Yeah, 80-ton rock column on your little canoe.
And they're stacked up in walls 30 feet high. I mean, it's something else. Yeah. It makes Gunung Padang is very minor in size compared to Namadol. But in my mind, and I talk about this in my book there, Lost World of Cam, that probably it was the Cam, and I would think at some time in, you know, maybe 500 BC or something like that, were building this, both places, and somehow they have these Buddhist masterminds, whatever, and they're Vamanas, their technology, they've got power tools, and they were able to levitate stone, particularly this basalt. Basalt is magnetic, actually. It's a naturally magnetic stone. Compasses start to spin if you go around basalt, usually. It's been magnetized. Basalt, extremely dense and heavy stone, almost very difficult to cut and work. You need, basically, today we need diamond tools and saws and drills and stuff like that to work to cut basalt. Mm. What you see there at Namadol and at Gunung Padang is uncut basalt. I mean, it hasn't been, but see, at My Son in Vietnam, with the basalt there, they've taken that basalt and cut it into perfect slabs and then cut these keystone cuts and stuff into it. I mean, they are slicing and dicing basalt like it was, you know, butter, practically. And, you know, how they could do it. But they're also able to levitate these things. I mean, I'm totally convinced of that. And at Namadol, I mean, that's the story. I mean, I can't see any other way that they would have been able to move all that material unless they could levitate it.
We're discovering more and more evidence of ancient builders, periods around where you're discovering. And my focus is on Central America, that a lot of the energy was locating these magnetic stones that had veins of quartz in them or granite or were andesite that had the ability to pass electricity through them. So I don't disagree with you. I think it's a great possibility. The big challenge, though, is what is the technology? What is the physics behind levitating stone? Where are the machines? It's just, we have to just in many ways kind of just theorize or hypothesize what would have been the techniques to do that. And that's the question, you know. I mean, our technology today probably isn't as advanced as the guys that built those megalithic structures. It's just strange to consider.
Well, yeah, I mean, they knew something that we don't know yet, or it's being kept a secret from us. Yeah. NASA and the military, they have done experiments on what they call acoustic levitation, using sound and vibration to levitate things, magnetic type rays. You know, even the whole UFO kind of thing and these flying triangles and other special technology. They themselves are, you know, there's a levitation and an anti-gravity effect that's being used there. Also, even I find a certain analogy with the lightsabers in the Star Wars movies. And this whole idea of like a handheld sort of plasma cutter. I mean, this is a kind of, it's like a mining tool in many ways, the lightsabers, because what those can do is like cut rock, and cut rock too in very, you know, sharp angles and things like that, a very clean cut, kind of a, like a lasers can do that. And masers, so it's like they had some ability like that to melt stone. You have to have electricity. They had the kind of electricity that we have today. And I'm a big fan, of course, of Nikola Tesla and all of his work. And I somehow, I mean, we live today in a kind of an oddball world that of science that has this sort of blinded about things. And part of that, it has to do with oil companies. Since World War II, really, we've been taught that energy is oil. Even a lot of people think that electricity has to be made with gasoline or oil. It's not. The idea that we have to go into space by firing a giant firecracker under our ass, and you know that whole thing. I mean, that's, if Nikola Tesla had survived World War II, he died during World War II in 1943. You know, and if he had been somehow part of the space industry, you know, we'd have a completely different type of space industry that would be based on electric type of craft, like we think of flying saucers and stuff, not these rockets. So the whole idea that it's sort of like electricity is really where it's at, and electrical tools and electrical craft, spacecraft should be electric, and sort of the music of the spheres and all that, even in tools and things, our cars should all be electric ultimately. I mean, petrol really just be used for chemical engineering and making plastics and things like that. So, but we're not really taught that. So we're sort of blinded into this idea that we need nuclear power and we need oil. People don't understand even that nuclear power plants, all they do is they're giant steam kettles. All the atomic power, all it's doing is boiling water. I mean, that's what a nuclear power plant does, is boil water for steam engines. So what creates electricity as we know it is rotating magnetic fields. I mean, that's what creates AC power. And I mean, it's magic. Rotating magnetic fields that, you know, can be from a wind turbine. Everyone's got one in their car, an alternator wound with copper cables and stuff like that. So ancient people had that too. And I believe that they had flight. They had power tools. They had some kind of levitating rays or something, acoustic things. There's a famous story that perhaps you've heard of, Cliff, because you're pretty knowledgeable about these things. This is supposedly in the late 40s, this Swedish aircraft engineer was in Tibet, and he witnessed and allegedly filmed with a 16-millimeter camera these Tibetan monks using horns and drums and levitating stones up on top of a cliff.
Yeah.
And they were building a monastery on this in Tibet. A lot of these monasteries are on remote cliff locations and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he was allegedly, and here are these Buddhists, you know, who are doing this, and he's seeing them. He claims he saw it, and he supposedly filmed it. But the film is, you know, it's kept in some vault or something in Sweden, and it hasn't been released. And so who really knows what the story is? But
yeah,
it's interesting, that kind of a thing. The other thing I would say, too, with acoustic levitation and stuff like that, which NASA has done experiments on that, but that's with our space program. You know, we have other space programs, too. The military, both the Navy and the Army, have their own space programs, too. And what they do is secret. We don't know what experiments they do. We don't know what even kind of craft and weapons and things they develop, because they don't have to tell us, but NASA does.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that they might have stuff like that. Certainly these extraterrestrials that are supposedly, you know, landing and doing stuff, they their technology must be pretty advanced, too. So
I'm hoping that in the near future we develop scanning technology that can actually scan stones that are megaliths to see what the properties are. There's so many ancient sites that have evidence of acoustic technology or whatever, but we just can't penetrate it because we don't have any scanning ability to know what is the properties. It's just we're behind. I mean, it's like we are coming back into a level of scientific understanding that is old, that was is ancient. You know.
Well, it's interesting that you're saying that, because basalt, particularly, and granite as well, have the ability to maybe store, like a magnetic tape or something, or a memory stick, to store information in it.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's possible that like basalt or something could be recording, you know, what had happened with it and how it was cut. I was at a remote island called Rotuma in the very north of Fiji some years ago, and it has also huge slabs of basalt, which were cut and moved into this one village. And the whole village kind of does stuff around them. They're like kind of cut like giant coffee tables or something. And they're huge, too. And they weigh many tons, like 40, 50 tons, maybe 60. And they told me that this Japanese scientist had been there some months before and had spent several weeks there doing exactly what you're talking about with these stones. And he was measuring the magnetism and all these little subtle energy things on those stones.
Very
because
cool.
He knew that they had been moved somehow and cut. And how that would have been done, you know, no one could really explain. And he was therefore doing these like special experiments. And I had never heard of anything like that before.
Yeah.
You know, scientists.
It's going to be independent sciences to do it, I'm sure. It's like, I mean, look, SpaceX sending rockets into space and landing them again. I people keep telling me we're going to have Musk's going to go and do a trip to Mars before anybody else does.
Well, right. I mean, I agree. It's fantastic. I'm always thrilled to hear of any of Elon Musk's new ideas and what he's doing, and Richard Branson, for that matter, and plenty of other people too. And I agree. It's these kind of private adventurer types who are really going to do stuff. I'm convinced that the military has got all kinds of stuff. They even may be on the moon and Mars already. But, you know, they keep that all a secret. But what NASA does is something else entirely. And, you know, they don't even have a spaceship themselves at this point. But I can tell you right now, the Navy and the Army, they have their own spaceships and launch vehicles and everything, but you don't hear much about
nothing them. Surprises me in America. I think we have some personality disorders. Hey, David, one last question for you, and then I'll let you go. You have a whole section on your in this new book on the Olmec, and the Olmec are a favorite of yours. But one thing I want to ask you is, do you believe the Olmec were a trans-oceanic culture? Were they actual? I mean, we see it again with the various racial types that appear in their sculptures and their artifacts and things like that. But what's your opinion lately in some of the research?
Well, I definitely think they were transoceanic, and they were the Olmecs were, in a sense, coming from both sides of Mexico. The Olmecs are mysterious in that way, and what the Olmecs occupied in Mexico was essentially what's called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And the Isthmus of Tehuantepec is the narrowest part of Mexico. And that's really southern Mexico, like the Oaxaca area, which is also where you have the megalithic sites of Monte Alban.
Right.
And then Mitla is also in that area. And then you cross over to really Palenque, Villahermosa, Comacalco, and Levante, which is right there on the Atlantic side, at the very sort of southwest corner of the Gulf of Mexico there. So there, and that in fact was what they think was the Olmec capital city was right around there, near the Atlantic side on in an area called Levante. But the Olmecs really started on the Pacific side. And it's something that people don't often understand about the Olmecs, is that, yeah, they're on the Pacific coast of Mexico, too, and all up and down the coast, and in the Pacific coast of Guatemala, where, and if you read my book, Mystery of the Olmecs, I get into a lot of that, too, that the Olmecs were, there's a lot of Olmec stuff in Guatemala. There's Olmec stuff in Costa Rica and even Panama. So the Olmecs were doing an interesting thing. They were a culture, and the Mayans essentially did this, too, at a later time. They were a culture on both the Pacific and the Atlantic coasts of Central America. So they could have ports, you know, that as the Spanish did later, that exactly the same thing. And they used Acapulco as their main Pacific port, and then they would send the galleons to the Philippines every year. So basically, the Olmecs were doing the same thing. Before they built the Panama Canal, they looked at three areas in Central America. One was Panama, the other was the lake and river system of Nicaragua, and then the third was the Isthmus of Tehuantepec in Mexico. And they considered building a canal in each of these areas and ultimately chose Panama. What the Mexicans did instead was build a railway between the two oceanic ports. But basically, the Olmecs had all that. And here's the other thing, too. There are these Olmec jade Celts, and today they were found at Levante, but today they're at the museum in Mexico City. And in the year 2000, they brought over the top Chinese expert on early Chinese writing and characters, which is Shang Chinese characters. And he identified the characters that are on these jade Celts, the kind of axe heads, and he identified them as early Chinese characters. So, and the Smithsonian Institution went along with that. They said, too, and this is what Michael Coe and these guys are all kind of having to admit, that, yeah, the early Olmec characters are really from ancient China. And it's from those characters that we get Mayan. The Mayan hieroglyphs all developed from that, and the number system, too, and the calendar, too, that the Mayans used. It started with the Olmecs, for sure, and exactly where the Olmecs, you know, where that all began was with, apparently, Shang China. See, and that also fits into the CAM, in that the Chinese and everybody, they would meet at these CAM Islands in Vietnam, and that's when they would head from there out into the Pacific. That's what I'm saying in my book. And see, the CAM Islands are perfectly located to then go directly east, right through the southern Philippines, and then you're out into the Pacific, and then you're going to Tahiti and Marquesas, and then ultimately you hit Mexico, and then even you can go from there to South America and to Peru, and then return again, like through Easter Island. So that, you know, it's obviously that's what they were doing, and so it was the Chinese and the CAM and then these Indonesians and stuff, and they were all these kind of Hindu Buddhist characters, except for the Chinese guys, who were, they were a little bit different. They were Taoist, and some of them were Buddhists and stuff, too. So it's an interesting, you know, mixture of people, and that's what the Olmecs were too. That Mayans were more of a kind of a homogeneous racial group, but the Olmecs were all kinds of different racial characters. They were Middle Eastern. They were Indian Hindus. They were black guys. They were Chinese-looking guys. Just like America is today, such a melting pot of different races and, you know, groups from all over the world. That's what the Olmecs were similarly like that, too, in ancient times.
Fascinating. I think we have our timeline screwed up, personally. I think a lot of these cultures go tens of thousands of years in the past, and we just don't know about it. There's stories about various independent archaeologists doing digs and finding dates that go back 40, 50, 60, 80,000 years in the past, and we don't acknowledge it, but it's just one of those things that has to come out. I think you're a futurist, David. This new book, The Lost World of the Cham, The Trans-Pacific Voyages of the Champa, the Kampa, I think it's a piece of work that's kind of looking to the future.
Well, I appreciate that, and it is. I mean, if what I'm saying in my book is true, and everything points to it being pretty accurate, then yeah, it's a whole new history, not just of Southeast Asia, but of Mexico and even the American Southwest and Peru and South America too. So
I have to write it out though. I have to write calm, not Cham. It's a calm.
Well, it's just like Cambodia. All right.
Cambodia. Yeah.
The word for Cambodia is coming from the same word as the Cham and the Kampa.
Right.
So that's
fantastic.
The Cham and the Cam. Well, look, I hope that your listeners can go check our website out at adventuresunlimitedpress.com.
Uh-huh. Right.
And we have our magazine, too, the World Explorer magazine. Have you maybe seen that?
I have seen that. You have a tremendous amount of authors that we have on the show, and you seem to publish a lot of great cutting-edge stuff. I don't know, how many titles do you have now? You must have 1,000, easy, right?
Well, yeah, the book publishing company has around, we've got about 300 books that we've published.
Oh, 300? Okay.
About 300, and I'm the author of about 30 books that I've authored or co-authored and edited and stuff.
When did you start?
So have them check out the magazine at wexclub.com. We're the World Explorers Club, and it's WEXCLUB, wexclub.com.
Okay. David, when did you start writing? What was your first book?
Oh, my first book was a book in 1983 called A Hitchhiker's Guide to Africa and Arabia, and it was published by Chicago Review Press. Yeah.
You were writing forever. Yes, I had this little image of you with a voice recorder, and you have everything transcribed because you don't have any time to do anything, and especially write. So you have it transcribed, you put your edit on it, and that's it. Is that how it goes? Am I right?
Well, yeah, no. Well, fortunately, I do know how to type, so I'm able to do that.
Well, I know Cliff, that, but you're just so busy is what I mean.
Well, yeah, I do have a lot to do, and I travel a lot. I love to travel and go places and go to museums, and I'm planning my next trip now. It's been fun being on your show.
Thank you, David.
All the best to all your listeners.
Fantastic. Appreciate it. We're going to post the book on the Facebook page. We'll let everybody know about the website. And thank you for your time, David. Much success.
All right. Thanks, Cliff.
So that was David Hatcher Childress, and I hope you enjoyed that interview. That book is now available on Amazon. It's got some of the most amazing photography I've seen in it. The color photography, the black and white isn't great. The color photography inside is quite interesting. And I found that Vietnam, a place that I had no idea had ancient cultures in it, has some of the most fascinating sculptures you can imagine. As a reminder, if you're interested in getting that free magazine, what you need to do is go to earthancients.com and register. And when you register, you'll receive the newsletter. This will be part of the newsletter, and it should be out, I'm going to say, within the next few days, because I'm almost done with it. I just want to have the radio show, let people know about it. And it's the Ancient Mysteries and Advanced Archaeology Review. You heard from Bruce Cunningham, the publisher. And it's quite a cool magazine. And he's making it available fairly inexpensively if you want to continue on. I think he's going to even give you a discount. But if you're not interested, hey, you got a full issue for free, earthancients.com. And sign up and you'll get the magazine. I'm going to try doing more of those. I mentioned this in the past. I'm going to try having additional giveaways because so much material is out there. There's tons of ebooks that people don't know about that that I can send you. So ancients.com. My guest next week is Jim Willis. He's a professor of history, retired professor of history. He has written a new book called Ancient Gods, Lost Histories, Hidden Truths, and the Conspiracy of Silence. He is quite unique in that he is an academic who believes that a tremendous amount of our history has been hidden from us, and that's what Earth Ancients is all about. That's next week on the show. It's Saturday, 22nd. Stay tuned. I think you're going to enjoy that. Have a great day. Happy Easter to you tomorrow. And be well.